put them in the satsang bowl.
Okay, one more time, namaste and om namo narayana. Without further ado, we will start with the questions. To what extent should the sadhaka care for the welfare of the guru? Well, it just depends on how long you want the guru around. In most ashram settings, pretty much the sadhakas do everything around the ashram. The guru's only function in most ashrams is to solely give satsang and to direct their guidance for their spiritual paths and to spend time in meditation. So usually that's the sole function of gurus in established ashrams in India. Okay. Yeah, or here. This has been an unusual happening the way that it's been. I've been doing a little bit more than most gurus are doing, yeah. So it's time for things to start to shift a little bit to free up some more of my time so I can spend some more time for meditation and just strictly doing hands-on work with people because we're having a lot of success with doing the hands-on healing work with people. So it's clearing out a lot of issues for them on all levels, physical, mental, emotional. So I want to really have the time to do more of that work for the sadhakas to help them. And hopefully I'll have some people in place. I've just started giving Siddhananda a couple of males to do. So I'm going to start giving her some more responsibility in answering some of the mails. It's time. It's time for her to start moving into that. So on the Kundalini, yeah, the Kundalini questions, I'm going to give her more responsibility to start to answer those. So that will free up also some of my time. So things are going to be started to be put into motion more towards this. But yeah. In most ashrams, you know, the guru's not having to go out and do the cooking, the cleaning, the shopping, the errands, the mail, the appointments, the scheduling, the finances, the payment, and all of that to date I've been doing for 5 years. So things are going to start, hopefully, becoming more into an organization. As far as the getting the incorporation and things, I haven't heard anything more with that down south. I don't know if you know Swamiji's dog Caesar had to be put down. So he's been kind of pulled back from things for a while, and I'll have to get a hold of the guy that was supposed to be doing that function down there and see if he's going to do it or if he's not. And if not, I'll see if I can get the stuff turned over so that we can get that in motion. So. Okay. I had a couple of these things I put in here as well because I wanted to cover it. One is on assumptions. I have a lot of people that, you know, when you tell them something or you don't tell them something, they start reading between the lines. And one thing you'll find out gurus do, they don't leave something to have something read between the lines. If you're reading something between the lines and making assumptions, stop yourself. Because if there's something that needs to be said, it's going to be said. If something's not said, then don't try to create something else that's happening that's not there. Okay, this has been happening in a few instances. Like one person had made an assumption and read between the lines that they weren't supposed to call. Well, you said I can't call. No, I've never said that. Anyone is able to call at any time and speak with me. So he went back through the mails and found out, no, that I never said that. So people make assumptions. They read into things, you know. Or someone will come up with, well, are you angry about something? I said, did I say anything that I was angry? No. Well, then I'm not angry. Don't read between the lines of, you know, thinking that this should have been done or that should have been done. And, you know, if there's a problem, come with me, come to me directly and ask. But usually take it at what needs to be said is going to be said. If it's not said, then don't make an assumption and read between the lines. Because most often you wind up, or you're creating a story that really...
Well, it's different with most people, and then they really don't come out and say...
Yeah, you need to use the mic.
Most people will not be... come out and say exactly what they mean.
I have no problem. I have no problem with saying what needs to be said.
It's different with a guru.
Yeah.
They don't hold back.
No. If there's something that needs to be said and cleared, I will say it. Absolutely.
Great.
Okay. So, yeah. If there's any question or any doubt, ask me immediately. Don't wait till some big story's created and, you know, you're kind of going off on a, you know, on another avenue that really doesn't need to be pursued. Okay, ashram etiquette is the other thing I wanted to bring up. We will be having Indian devotees coming and going. I have a couple that's flying in fact, the 2nd, 3rd of March to be worked on. The woman's a doctor. I think we've spoke with you about that. When Indian devotees are coming in, we need to have some type of ashram etiquette when it's concerning guru, because in India, you don't ever come up and touch the guru. It's just, it's not done. It's and when you address your guru, it's always Guruji. You never address your guru as Swami. Okay, so for those that have taken Diksha, from now on, I think what we need to do is start to change this. The ones that have taken sannyas, they are addressed as Swamiji. Okay? Like, not Swamiji, Swamiji, J-I. It's a title of respect showing that they have made this commitment to the path. So when you're addressing the Swamis here, address them as Swamiji. And when you're addressing me, if you have taken Diksha, then it's Guruji. For those that have not taken Diksha, then it's Swamiji. That's fine. Okay? So just, you know, and when you see me, don't run up and give me a hug or slap me on the back or, you know, because the poor Indian devotees will just be like horrified, you know. You don't sit in the guru's chair. You don't slap the guru on the back. You don't, you know, talk unless spoken to. That's the way it is in India. They pranam before they leave. So don't be surprised when you see Indian devotees, they will come and touch my feet immediately when they come in. That's pretty standard because it's just the way it is with. So we want to, you know, carry forward a little decorum when they're around so they're just not absolutely in shock that people are so disrespectful to gurus here. Okay. I don't take offense at it, but, you know, there's just that cultural thing that...
I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to be doing now.
We need the mic.
See, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing to be doing now.
Yeah, it's just sometimes, you know, when you have initiatory, when you have people from this culture come in, they don't understand it either. They think that I'm sitting up here and that I'm saying, you must, you know, you have to be this way, and it's, you know, they don't understand. And so sometimes they take it the wrong way. This is one reason that I've been so lax in this area. You know, because they come up with they don't understand that protocol.
I think it's lovely that you are so flexible, but I think that one thing that all of us need to think about, since we are the core group and we are the people who are starting the ashram, is that we can establish what the etiquette is. And I happen to think ashram etiquette is lovely, and I miss it here.
Okay. So there will be more of the ashram etiquette being put into place. You know, this is a learning experience for a lot of people that are not used to, you know, they're just not used to it, and I understand that. So, you know, this is why it's been very flexible. But now that it's being more organized, it needs to, you know, and we've got swamis now, and plus a guru, that it needs to become a little bit more structured. So any of the swamis that are here, Swami Alakananda and Swami Niranjananda and Swami Premananda and Swami Siddhananda, when you address them, please, it's Swamiji, in recognition of their vows. Okay?
How about for the swamis addressing you?
It's Guruji. Okay. It's Guruji. Yeah. If you see another swami that's out, they will address as Swamiji. Although most of them won't know that I'm a swami because I'm wearing the blacks and red, which is, you know, the Kali. I'm no longer constrained to wear the clothes of a swami because I've graduated to guru, so you could say. Graduated to guru, and because I'm a Kali devotee, I wear a lot of the blacks and reds more than the Swami colors. But sometimes I still wear the oranges. But, you know, it's the same thing here. We're a little more lax, you know. You don't have to run around in Swami wear. You know, you're not constrained to wear orange all the time. You're not constrained by that because this is a different society than it is in India. You know, we need to make this a workable system for the society that we're in. And most of the people here all have jobs. Even if you're a swami, you still go out and you still work in the world here. So what we're in the process of is trying to update this a little bit to make it more workable within the societal context that we're in here. Because people here can't take sannyas, and you can't go wandering around with a bowl. You can't live on the sidewalk and build a fire. You know, you just, it's not doable here. So we're trying to take the basics of taking sannyas, which is to dedicate your whole life to the path and to forwarding this path to mankind and to spend your time as wisely as you can to reach realization, to make that your goal, your commitment is to this path, to mankind, to realization, and to do what you can do in the area that you're at to further that. Okay? So, but we just do it a little differently here. Just as valid, but it's just a little different dynamic.
Besides the greetings, can you go over some of the ashram etiquette? You come in, you ring the bell. Is that one of the
etiquettes? This is what you do if you're going in a temple. When you go in a temple, I just hung this up here. When you go in a temple, you ring the bell. It's kind of like you let the deities know I'm here. Mm-hmm. Okay. But that's not needed in the ashram. Basic ashram etiquette is to come in and just be respectful. To donate time, if you have some free time, donate time to doing some seva around the ashram. You know, I would like to put up an ashram sign-up sheet for seva, for somebody that would like to come in and clean, or someone that would like to, you know, take care of, you know, getting together the potlucks to, you know. But we need people that are committed to do this. You know, we need people that are committed, not just show up haphazardly. You know, we need people to start making more commitment to be here. Okay. Did you have a question?
Hi. Yeah, I like the idea of the ashram protocol and etiquette, and I think sounds like most of us do too, because it's devotion and reverence to our path, to you, to...
Yeah, it's also devotion and reverence to yourself as well. Mm-hmm. You know, when you respect the guru and you respect the swamis and you respect that, it also engenders respect within yourself, because that's where you're headed. You know, that's what you're headed. That is your goal.
Yeah, and I think if you tell us, or maybe Premananda tell us, as he sees things that are happening and reminds us right then we can adjust right away, because I think that's what we prefer to do. I'd rather know right now rather than 2 weeks from now that of the protocol, because I'd rather do it now.
Okay. Then maybe you should try to make a list of the ashram protocol and things. I'll try to work on some of that.
Yeah, it would be good. And then you could post it maybe?
Yeah.
On the internet?
Well, I can post it, or we can put it up in the main hall or something when you come into the ashram.
Yeah, that would be good.
So kind of rules, you know, no excess, you know, loud, you know. It doesn't mean you can't be, you know, you can't joke, you can't have a good time. But, you know, also keep in mind that it is an ashram.
And then, yeah, Premananda, you get to be guardian of the rules. Or clarification of the temple, or but that'd be good.
I'll walk around with a sledgehammer. Yeah.
You got it. So moving right along, that was it for my things that I wanted to touch on this week. Can you speak a little bit about doing things partly versus doing them completely? I feel like I'm a partial doer. Who is our partial doer? My partial doer. Well, as far as doing things completely, there's doership. You don't want to get into too much doership, where I need to be doing this and I need to be doing that, you know, because then you can get into the trap of trying to be good enough, you know. So that's not where you want to be. But you want to do the best that's possible, and then surrender the results of it, or surrender what comes for that. So the thing is, you want to be able to eventually come into a sattvic mode, or that which is... where it becomes your natural flow. Okay, it just becomes the natural flow, and then you let go of doership. You know, if you're going to do something, it doesn't do any good to do it halfway.
Well, my mind might be on the next thing I have to do, but with you, you just do one thing and you're very enthused about it, and you finish that, and then you go on to the next thing.
Right, right. Yeah, because if you're dividing it up as to what's coming next, then you're not fully present. Okay, if you've got a thing, you know, if you've got a number of things to do, make a list. Okay, so it's not on the mind thinking, oh, I've got to do this next, I've got to do that, because you know, this is also part of the practice, doing the one thing at a time. Okay, put your full attention on the thing that you're doing in this moment, and that's it. Then it becomes also a moving type of a meditation for you. Okay, it can actually move you into stillness and more centeredness when you're doing the one thing at a time versus being scattered with trying to, you know, halfway do and thinking of something else that you've got to do, or, you know.
Well, especially in the morning, I'm interested in other people's opinions, too. I feel like I've got to do all these things, and I do my mantra and my meditation, but in my mantra and my meditation, in the spaces come in these other things that I have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So when those things start popping in, just recognize that it's popped in and go back into the mantra and the meditation and don't think that, oh, my God, this is coming in and now I've, you know, then you go off on another tangent. Okay. So when that happens, just recognize that it's come in and you just forget about it, you know, ignore it and just continue on with what you're doing with the mantra and the meditation. And just try to put even more devotion behind that, and that helps to also cut the rest of the chatter, because if you're doing it mindlessly, okay. you've done that a few times. Yeah, I saw. If you're doing it mindlessly, you might as well be putting it on a tape recorder or have a parrot doing it, okay. So this is why we develop the bhakti, the devotion. So when you're doing your mantra, you're doing your, you know, meditation, japa, you know, then do it from the heart, attention and intention when you're doing it. Because if the mind's wandering, then guess what? It's only got half attention and intention on your practice. Okay? So put full attention and intention on it. And see if that helps. It will eventually. Moving right along. Don't feel bad. This is a common problem for people that are... It takes a while to get fully centered. But, you know, when things come in, don't sit and beat yourself up about it. You know, just bring your attention back again. Because if you're trying to corral it again, you know, you're just feeding it even more. So you don't want to feed it. You want to starve it. Okay. How can I let go of complaining? And why does it feel so good to complain? Well, recognize that you're complaining and see it. The first step to letting go of it is to see it. So the first step's been made already, okay? The second step is the recognition that it sometimes feels good to complain. So start to question, what is this that's feeling good when it's complaining? What is this I that's feeling good when it's complaining? And start to question that. Okay, this will take you into more of the self-inquiry. Am I this mind? Am I this body? Am I these emotions? Okay. But it's good, the recognition, to start to see these things. I'm not going to just say and tell it, sit and tell you, well, just stop. Don't complain. But when, you know, sometimes when there's complaining, you can also do the other practice of just telling yourself, stop. The only thing that's happening in this moment is, and bring it down to base level. Like if something was coming in my mind right now, say, stop. The only thing that's happening at this moment is I'm sitting in a chair and I'm giving satsang, and that's it. Okay? Whatever else is coming in has nothing to do with anything. In this moment, the only thing that's happening is, then I'm sitting here giving satsang. Okay? So you might bring yourself more back to present exactly with what's happening now. Because most complaining usually has to do with something that's happened before, that's coloring what's going on now. Okay? And the last of the questions in the satsang bowl. If nobody else has any questions coming up, it's going to be a very short satsang session today, I think. To what extent Does the guru use personal resources towards the benefit of devotees? And what extent should sadhakas offer their personal resources to their spiritual path and their guru? Well, most of the resources that I have are put towards ashram things. Whatever the personal income that I have is used to offset most of the, you know, some of the cost of the ashram. Okay? This is not all just donations that are coming in that are supporting it. It's my money that I have from the VA that's being put in towards the rent of the ashram. It's my personal money that I've used to pay the cell phone costs to speak with devotees. My personal money that's been used to keep the internet going. Okay? None of that's been taken out of donations. Okay? How long I'll have that source of income, I don't know. But what I have now has been put towards as much as I can do, you know, to keep things going for people. Okay. As you know, I was started out in a one-bedroom place, and then I moved up here and paid more, $200 more a month here, so that we could have additional space so people could come. Okay. So what I have, I try to use in the best possible manner for the devotees. As far as the sadhakas, Premananda is going to continue to pay what he was paying for his rent towards the maintenance of the ashram. So he's committing, what was it, $600 a month towards that. Okay? I don't care what the spiritual tradition you're in, whether it's Christian, whether it's Hindu, whether it's Muslim, it doesn't matter. All of them speak to the giving, you know, and supporting. I mean, even Christ, when he was there, they had, you know, the one that wound up being the betrayer was the keeper of the funds. They had funds because people were giving along the way, you know. They say a worker is worthy of his hire. In all traditions, they have some way to support their spiritual teachers, the spiritual, the ones they're giving spiritual sustenance. Christians have tithing. It should be the 10%. What they are advocating is 10% of the salary. No one here is doing anywhere near 10% of salary. Okay? It's not mandatory. None of these things are made mandatory for anyone that are coming. But this is only going to grow, you know, it's like anything in the world. It takes money, you know, to have a place, to be able, you know, I give all the services I can give. Whether people donate or don't donate, I still do the healing work. I have some that come that don't give anything for healing work, okay? I have some that come that give quite well for healing work. It's all over the map, but there's no set charge. You know, if somebody doesn't have money and they come, I have been known to pay their food, pay their, you know, pay everything when they get here out of my pocket. I take them out to the restaurants. If I go out to eat, they go out to eat. And I'll foot the bill. So I give what I can give, you know, whatever level I can give. If they want to call, I'll spend as much time as I can to work with them on the phone. If they come, I'll do hands-on healing work with them. I give what I can give. But I have only so much resources. Okay. Everyone has a different level or a different area where they can give. Not everyone can give monetarily, okay? Not everyone is in a financial position that they can do that. If you are in a financial position that you can do that, it would be a great area to help give. For people that need to come, that just simply don't have the finances to come out here, okay? Some people need to have that, you know, underwriting where somebody can fund them to come out for healing. Some people are too ill. A lot of the people I start working with are too ill to work at the moment. Okay, they simply cannot work. Those of you that are in the midst of Kundalini Awakening, you know how difficult it can be. So some people, sometime during their journey, are in too much of a difficult position to be able to work. Okay. Like one, I'm just now starting the council. She was a nursing nun. And a Kundalini awakened, and she's having a very, very difficult time. And she was a nursing nun working with cancer victims. She's now in India. She's having to sell her home in England. She's losing everything. It would be wonderful for her to be here for some time, to be able to live here so that I could work with her one-to-one and get her stabilized again, so that she can go back into the world and provide the services that she can do for others. Okay. But at this present time, she doesn't have the funding to come. Okay. So what I would like to see eventually is for this organization to grow, for more people to become healers in a correct way. Okay. For more people to be able to give back to society on a lot of different levels. Okay. But in order for this organization to grow, it does take funding, unfortunately. So whatever anyone can give, you wind up getting it back some way. Okay. I'm not going to be here like these faith, you know, like some of the Christians say, give out of your pain and you'll be, you know, 10 times blessed. I'm not going to tell you that. Because if you're giving financial, it doesn't always come back financially. Okay? That's simply not the case. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But you can't give out of greed and say, well, if I give this and it's hurting now, I'm going to get it back tenfold, you know. I'm going to become rich then, you know. I'm not going to tell you that. This is not the prosperity. Okay, prosperity hour, I'm sorry. But it does, you know, it does, when you start giving, it does open the heart. When the heart starts opening, then you can receive more as well. So it does have benefits. It does have benefits. I know I used to give the Christian ministries and stuff, and it was like, when I really needed a helping hand, I went to them, and they wouldn't help me at all at that point. It was not a good thing. Kind of hardened my heart there for a while. But, yeah. So anyway, I leave this up to the people that are coming. How much you want to commit. It has to be an individual choice. Nobody's penalized because you don't. But if somebody here is rich and they come and they donate a whole lot, they're not going to be treated any differently either. Okay? I've seen this so many times in ashrams in India. When I live in Rishikesh, if somebody rich is coming, I mean, they redo the whole ashram, they roll out the red carpet, and, you know, so they're treated totally different than somebody else that's coming in. That's not right. That's not right. So here it's going to be across the board the same for anyone, whether they're giving, whether they're not giving. Okay? Also in this ashram, what you're going to find is I won't allow the politics to come in. I won't put up with any nonsense. When I first started out as a guru, I had one gentleman come. I was living up in Darjeeling at the time, and he'd heard about me. He came up to Darjeeling from Mumbai, and he had a lot of connections with the newspapers and everything in Mumbai. So he wanted to take me to Mumbai and really promote me in the newspapers, you know, and have lectures set up and all of this. And I saw the reason he wanted to do it was he wanted to make a big kickback. You know, this was going to be for him like a business thing, and I absolutely said no. So the thing is not to become, you know, not to lose your parameters with this. Okay. I don't want ashram politics coming in. This is one reason that I've kept everything so, you know, the way that it's been, with not really trying to go out and really promote an ashram over anything else. I'm not going to sell integrity to do that. Okay? It's not worth having funding when it comes at that type of a price. So whether we grow or whether we don't remains to be seen. But I would like to see everyone here become very stable and for this to move forward in a correct manner. Okay. So we will go ahead and take a break here for today. Namaste. Thank you for coming. We've got two teapots there. So there's a lot of tea, a lot of different teas up there for those that would like to have a tea break, restroom break, and then we'll come back for meditation. Namaste. Thank you.